Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Where are we?
We're in Mendrisio, which is about 4 kilometres north of the border to Italy, and 4 kilometres from my house as well, or where my European base is. I'm actually Australian. I rent a house in Europe, I own a house in Australia. So where is my home? I've been moving around all my life. I don't know what a home is, but my European base is here in Switzerland in a little town called Stabio, a couple of kilometres from where we are now in Mendrisio. But Mendrisio was also host city to the World Championships in, I think, 76 or 77, and won by none other than a Belgian guy called Eddy Merckx. And also in 2009, won by a local guy who is just down the road here by the name of Cadell Evans, i.e. me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we're just about to get onto what was the 2009 Worlds course.
Uh-huh.
So it came up from the right here, took a right at this roundabout. We're going to go up here. Now this was the main climb, the harder of the climb.
Yeah, and this hill is a bit of a drag, isn't it?
So yeah, so this was the main and the hardest climb, where, as usual in the world, everyone looks at the biggest, longest one, everything's going to happen here. There is another one. But this one, you carried a bit of speed before we came from that roundabout. It was downhill and you had about 800 metres of flat. You're still carrying a bit of speed at the bottom, so in the peloton, this bit passed relatively unnoticed.
Do you know what? You're still climbing like you always used to. It's interesting when you see someone riding who you're used to seeing on the TV. And it's like 4 years since you retired. Even now, I can tell you still climb the same way. It's like a fingerprint, someone's climbing style.
Well, I often look at bike riders and also between personality types, rider types, but even physique. We'll take a left here. Now, this is where it starts to get a bit harder.
Tell me about it. Okay.
And I'm always interested in the relationship between people's physique and their mentality. But what leads it? Their physique or their mentality? Is it our mentality that leads our physique to develop, or is it we get physical and mentality from our parents? But
at the moment, my mentality is saying I'm too heavy.
Personality types, body types, there sort of seems to be a relationship. I'm really interested in book. At the moment,
yeah,
written by a runner, and he's always like ectomorphs, so introverted and reserved. Endomorphs are more outgoing. Anyway, we're sort of sidetracking. So this is the steepest part of the climb.
Yeah,
this here, you can hear the water. This climb's actually called Acqua Fresca, fresh water. There is a fountain just down there on the right. We'll probably fill our bottles up there later. This is probably the steepest part of the whole world's course.
Yeah, it was like 10, 12%, something like that.
Yeah, solid.
Yeah, this would be sapping. And how many laps of this did you do back in 2009?
14 laps, if I remember.
Yeah.
12, 14, just come over here.
It's getting warm now, though. I mean, it's saying on that sign by that shop, 27 Celsius.
Oh, really? Huh. That warm. It's the humidity here that's my pet hate in cycling. I could ride in any conditions. But I hated humidity.
Well, at least you got short sleeves. I'm overdressed.
Well, because I knew it was going to be humid today.
Well, I thought it was going to be wet.
Yeah, well, if it didn't rain, I would have found us a coffee shop already. I'll come here single file again.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a left here and we're going to go off the world's course onto training roads.
Okay.
Yep, so we're just going up by the church, the parochia. We take a right here. I think Michael Rogers might live on this road. I don't even know.
Does he?
Go into small gear now, I'd suggest.
Okay. Whoa. Okay, this is definitely a difficult climb.
So this is the last bit. I think it might be 27% at the top there.
27%. Okay. Might have realised.
This is real Giro weather. It's neither hot nor cold, but you sweat a lot.
It's a real Giro climb as well.
It is a little bit.
Wow. 400 watts just to creep up this thing.
Just to get up it, yeah. This was what I'd often use before the Ardennes Classics.
Yeah.
This lap here, just give you a feel.
Because of the repetition,
do like a six and the steep climb. Your arms hurt more than your legs on the steep section at the top there when you're going flat out.
Mm.
And I think I used to do sort of 620, 640 laps. We were like 745 or something at the time. So just get a feel for it. I don't do 640 lap times anymore.
Brutal though. I mean, just doing it up and down, that is, like you say, for the Ardennes Classics, for like Liège, perfect.
Because yeah, you just put lactate, downhill.
Yeah, on, off.
And then I actually come back here a bit, because if I need to get fit for an event, but I don't have much time to train, I come into a lap or two here, and a little ride or a bit, or this lap. We could do, now I'm just thinking we could do the other bigger one, which is, it's a 45 minute lap when we're going good.
To go towards Como?
And then, yeah, rather than do the whole thing back here, we'll get off at the Como end and then go down there and Dolce Vita di un ciclista.
Yeah. The passeggiata.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the stuff that pays the bills here, over there. That's
where you spend the money.
Let's go drink some water.
If it's something. Is it a spring?
There's a thing just here.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Since it's called Aqua Fresca, we should probably get some cool water. I've been talking but not drinking. Now tell me, is the water cold? Because it is called Aqua Fresca here.
Yeah, it's cold. So, once you'd won the world, what was the reaction like then? I guess the team's attitude had to change towards you at that point.
The cycling world changed around me. It was incredible. I had a year, a lot of people were blaming me. Oh, if Cadell had done this, if Cadell had done that, this and that. And then one race, you're the god of cycling, it seems. The way you're treated, the way you move in the peloton, the way you're regarded.
Respect for the jersey.
Yeah, but I'm still the same guy. And for me, it was notable to me. We went back to the hotel after the race and so on. And we had dinner with the team. I didn't go out or anything. I was just so relieved and happy and satisfied with my race. I didn't feel any need to have a big party or anything. And everyone tells you you're shit, you're hardly going to take them out and have a big party with them. sort of just, in a smug kind of way, happy just to enjoy it for myself. And we had dinner with the national team. Went home the next morning and I think the TV were waiting at home and, you got to do this and you got to do that and you're the world champion. I'm like, hang on a second. Going out for coffee with my dog and no, you got to do this. Oh, God.
Is it fair to say up to that point you were considered a bit of a nilly man, even though you'd been on the podium at Grand Tours.
I'd always been accused of not attacking, and I find this talk a bit superficial and talk to create talk.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who attacked Armstrong?
Yeah.
I rode my first Tour de France was in 2005, and I was turning myself inside out just to stay with him. to the last 10, the selection of the last 10, and I remember my first hilltop finish in 2005. But that certainly, that's where for me the cycling world changed, that attitude of the, everyone changed towards me.
Yeah.
But like I'm saying, like, the TV's waiting for me at home, but I'm like, hang on, I'm still the same person, I'm still the same guy. I'm just going to go out and get a coffee, I take my dog, I read the newspaper and go for a ride or whatever.
Yeah. I think you are very down to earth. I think
for
a tour winner, for a world champion, we've met a few times before. You're hugely approachable, I find. And I, you know, having not known you when you were racing, the picture that was portrayed was completely the opposite to that, which is untrue. Yeah.
Which, well, for me, it's kind of frustrating. It's sort of like, why? Because my life in my house is my life. I don't want people to know. Or take a left up here. Yeah. That was a little bit sort of frustrating for me. Just some people they don't want their private life to be public.
And, no.
Well, it wouldn't be private life if it's public, is it? But I live my life. But that's like what I'm sort of trying to lead to here is I felt I was the same guy. I was doing the same training. I lived in this little apartment. Guess what? And the clothes hang up. And I remember a friend came around later that week or something. And, you know, I've got the clothes hanging to dry in the hallway of the apartment. And there's like three rainbow jerseys hanging up. For a pro rider to come in and see that, they're kind of like, oh. I was sort of like, oh yes, it has changed a bit, hasn't it? But for me, it was still the same, but the whole cycling world's attitude changed towards me. And that was kind of, in some ways, a little bit, there you see it all. Yeah. You're not treated for the person you are, but the results you've made.
Yes.
And which, as a human being, you're kind of like, does that not count for anything? So anyway.
But did that make a difference then, in the 2 years afterwards, the way the peloton treated you, the bigger cycling world treated you, because it was 2 years after you won the world, you then went on to win the Tour, having been runner-up twice and been on the podium at the World Tour.
Especially after the Tour, and I think that the following year, Flèche Wallonne. And well, the main thing what people didn't realise was the next year things did change for me. Well, I'd already been in discussions before the Worlds to go to the BMC team.
Yeah.
And when everyone changes around you, when all of a sudden I go from a team that was sort of, they were actually blaming me for a lot of things, to a team that's like, oh, this is great, he just wants to work hard and motivate the riders and work together as a team to get the best results we can. All of a sudden I found the ambient, which is fantastic for me, and we were just working towards the Giro, the Tour, and all these races. So the biggest thing for me, BMC, on a personal level in my profession, they have this fantastic press officer, George Luchingar, a Swiss guy, but he was just respectful of my health and well-being.
Yeah.
You've done enough interviews today. There are more requests, but you've done the most important ones. Go and get some rest. I'm just like, oh, this is heaven.
Sensible.
Because as opposed to just being wheeled out like a carousel at the fair or something. Oh, interviews, press conferences, left, right, and this, and like that for me was very difficult, which created friction within the press, because I'm just like, I just want to go to bed.
There is, I do remember a bit of footage of you basically running away from a crew through a hotel.
When
I think you said you're going to go and walk your dog. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, probably, yeah. It's just like, I just want to, can I just, okay, this is my job, this is my profession, but in every profession at a certain time, you clock off work, either you leave the office or you leave the construction site or you leave the workshop. And you go home, and of course the problems are still in your head, but that's every job. So we're going to take a left just up here.
We're still in Switzerland here.
Yep.
Where do we cross the border? I guess we have to go to Como.
So the mountain top there is it's still Switzerland on the other side of that mountain top. When we see the mountain top with the mobile communications tower on it, that's Italy.
Uh-huh.
Family activity, we drive to the village up there on the other side, park,
uh-huh.
and you walk up towards that, don't quite get to that big pointy mountain up there.
Yeah.
I think it's called Gran Sasso. You walk just across the border and there's this fantastic refugio. We walk there, the 5 months old on my, in the wrap on my chest.
Oh yeah.
My 8 year old, he was with us, is walking there, dawdling in the forest. Are we there yet? How much further?
Oh, I know.
But it's I like it as a family activity that we all do.
Good workout as well, carrying the baby.
And by the time you get up there, you deserve, they have this polenta uncha. It's polenta, they have really good polenta up there. made in an old mill. Is it garlic, sage, butter, and cheese?
Oh, sounds delicious.
On a cold day when you get up there, it's so satisfying.
Not pro cyclist food though, right?
No, but there's a 2-hour walk in the mountains to get there and a 2-hour walk back.
Yeah, you've earned it.
You nearly earned it. It's a beautiful sunny day.
It is. I was
in
just thinking
Ticino, so let's enjoy it.
Well, it lasts. But then, getting to the 2011 tour, how were you feeling in your head then? Did you have the confidence that you could go that bit further and win the whole thing?
Well, and I think it was a big thing. For me, I hadn't had too many problems. I went in there well. I wasn't considered a favourite by the press.
Because you're a bit older than the rest of the
34.
Field. 34. Yeah.
I think most people consider I was too old, because by then no one had won the tour at 34 for so long, I think.
And you're a non-European, which means the odds are stacked against you too.
But yeah, probably. But then also, but within our team, Quincy and George and these guys, they'd seen me racing. They'd seen me in the races. And I always had this thing with your teammates. I learnt this from guys like Bettini and Frey. Rather than tell or ask riders to do something, show you're worthy of their support. Just go there, look, I think I can be good today. If we can just get here, we'll see what I can do.
So lead by example rather than delegation, I guess.
And then they think, shit, if I don't do this, he might not win. But then that's a decision they're making.
Yeah.
That's pressure they're putting on themselves. And then they're thinking, well, that's what I need to do, rather than being told.
Can I just reflect on that wisdom that you received as well from riders like Bettini, Frere, hugely successful as well, George Hincapie, at your disposal, I guess, you know, one of the greatest domestiques of all time. He'd been there, done it, ridden so many grand tours. So to earn his trust must have been quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, well, initially when we first met as teammates or future teammates, he was like, the tour, and he really had his doubts. But then the feeling I got from them, something I reflect on, but they all went to altitude camps before, they'd done the classics, but I think they'd taken this, if we're firing on all cylinders as a team, going back to like taking the onus upon themselves, they went to altitude camps with their families and their girlfriends and things. I got the feeling they didn't want to be the weak link in the chain, because that might let down. So it was this, we built a real strong strength in unity. Of course, in the mountains, we weren't the strongest team. In the team time trial, we lost 2 riders in the first K or something. We were second by 2 seconds. So on the flat, we had a really good team, but anyway. But that built a real strong unity within us. And we just went about it. We knew what we had to do. Everyone wanted to do it as best they could. And we didn't have the fuss of being a favourite or, and then like having the great media manager and George Lutzinger by my side kept everything, any external factors towards me, sort of filtered them a bit, and just, so which helped me stay calmer and so just more relaxed, which is very important.
Yeah. What about the competition? What did you think
of that? Yeah, then the Schlecks, Bockler. Yeah, in some ways, because Contador had done the Giro that year, so he wasn't at the same level. And then, I don't know, seemed a little bit, after 2010, it seemed to have changed a bit, it seemed from the outside.
I've often wondered, when you're in one of those select groups during the tour with the other GC contenders, the Schlecks, Bockler, you mentioned, what's the conversation like? Is there any conversation? Do you say anything to each other?
You mentioned previously, not when we were recording, about Brad Wiggins. He's a complicated guy. So I remember riding, it was the year he was fourth, 2009, riding next to him. Anyway, he was on the climb as like the groups being selected. Still, I can't remember how many were left. It wasn't like the final selection, 2009, I was still there, so there's still a fair few riders left. And he was reciting lines from a movie that I knew. Okay. Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Oh, yeah. The original version.
Guy Ritchie film.
And he was reciting lines from that as we're getting dropped on the climb. And some guy's looking at him, what? What? And I was like, you have to have seen the movie to understand this. I thought, what a clever cryptic guy.
But he was actually he was in good form that year. But he crashed and broke
his
collarbone.
Early out. Yeah, it was a bit. I always had this thing for the tour. How do you win the tour? Well, first, don't lose it.
Yeah, and that's that first week is always crazy, right?
I think we get more information about the race, but there's also more road hazards, traffic islands, spectators. But of course, the more dangerous it is, the more nervous people get.
Uh-huh.
The more nervous people get, the more dangerous it becomes.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of vicious little circle that we do. This is on here. This is a test loop that I use for testing bikes.
Okay.
This section here. So buried road. We've got a bit of a downhill. One climb, another narrow downhill through the goats and things, and then we've got the last climb, which is pretty steep at the top.
Through the goats, you said, okay.
Yeah, there's goats and sheep. It makes it feel like you're really in the mountains. I think it's like one more climb up to the village.
Yep.
Then we have a descent, then we have a hard climb, but then it's mostly downhill nearly all the way to Italy. So
beautiful. I've just noticed we're descending on a fairly rough road. Cadell is standing up and then changing hands while standing up. So he's going downhill, standing up, no hands. Cannot compete with that.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
That was, I'm saying the same things about five times over, so I'll just stop. I'm just saying those corners, you have like high-speed corners, low-speed corners,
yeah,
good surface, bad surface, and then, of course, you have that bit, which is all about how's the compliance on the
that
frame.
Was
on
nuts.
Those cobbles, hit that at speed, and it's like, this doesn't absorb bumps much, or it's this like, or this does.
A Tour of Flanders or something.
Yeah, yeah, and it's but it's because you have a real mix of surfaces from here up to that town up there, which is where we're going to arrive to. You sort of cover nearly everything you're going to ride on, except gravel.
Yeah.
Got another little path over there that we'll be testing in the future with that. But it's all these corners I use and I know quite well. And because I know them so well, I sometimes do one bike and then another one, change bike and then another one, and you go back and do it again. You do like a time trial in this section here. But it gives you a really, you can find real subtle differences between the frame or way corners. So this one's just a little bit longer wheelbase than, say, the race one. So you notice on those corners, which are a bit slower speed, it's a bit slow to get around the corners,
right?
Whereas on the other side, where it's higher speed and smoother road, it's more stable because it is longer.
Yeah,
it's not
yeah,
as
yeah.
fast, but it's but like this one loves the descent on that side. This side's a little bit more technical and a little bit faster steering bike. Like the bike the guys race on is perfect for this stuff here.
And is that the job mostly these days, testing
often,
the new frames
part of
BMC?
Part of it, yeah.
Being an ambassador for them.
Yeah, last week I did a ride with journalists on a new model bike which we're launching soon. And that was to be with them, but to give always, what I normally try and do if time allows, go test the bike, then speak with the engineers and the designers and try and tell them, well, this is what feels like it's been changed. Now tell me. And then that's the best way to do it. Doesn't time and timelines and manufacture doesn't always allow for that. Just to give an honest feedback from a rider's point of view. And because I race mountain bikes and I was quite particular with my position and my equipment, I've got quite a good, I really had a really good feel for it as a racer, especially my position and things. And just because you ride exactly the same position, you have everything. So, and then, oh, 1 millimeter different here, 2 millimeters difference there. But then, because I've been riding different bikes, I sort of lost a little bit of that feel. I don't obviously ride as many hours, but also riding different bikes, you sort of lose a bit of that feel, but also you need to ride different bikes, make comparisons and so on. So anyway, I'm actually on this one today because we have a newer model, which is, it looks almost identical to go back and forth between the two to get a to feel the differences. So I have certain opinions which go against some of the things in cycling at the moment. I always run higher pressure in the bigger tyres if I ride the bigger tyres.
Yeah, like 120.
I'm still old school.
Old school.
Small, narrow, lighter, slower, less surface area, high pressure, less riding resistance, and put extra handlebar tape on if it's too rough. But there's efficiency and rolling resistance. So I'm just going to do a U-turn here, Matt. Engineers, I'll come back. 360, come back with you. Was my turnaround point for the test lap. The BMC engineers thought I was nuts and insisting on having that in the test course. What? It means nothing. No. Trust me. Slow, speed, stability is really important because when someone goes out and buys a 10,000 euro bike and they do a U-turn at the coffee shop and they crash in front of all their friends, they're not happy. That test is really important. The engineers thought I was a bit crazy.
That was a lung buster. Are we at altitude here as well? How high
No, we're not at altitude. We're about 380, 400 metres here. And from here on, it's mostly downhill, as in there's no steep climbs. But this is the top section of the Sassone, the big lap.
Yeah.
Which takes about 25 minutes to get here when you're like training as a pro, training good. I actually remember once, I've told this a story before, I think like that, just before that switchback, which we can see right there, I remember being here one day doing this training with all the laps. And I got, I think, towards the last big lap I was about to do here, right to there, and I went hunger flat like precisely at that tree there. You know how hard it was for me to descend all the way to Mendrisio and the first Coke machine I bought to buy Coke to ride the 6 kilometres home? Because I was so
cooked.
Empty. Just to do the downhill back to the Mendrisio, I was like, oh.
Let's just finish off the story, though, about winning the Tour.
2011, yep.
Because it was a difficult one, but having said that, which Tour is ever easy? But in this instance, like you said, you had the Schleck brothers kind of ganging up on you, I guess.
Yeah, certainly having two GC contenders already then, because this is before Sky came into their strength, which was the next year with Froome and Wiggins.
Yeah.
But having two podium contenders on the one team was something we hadn't seen for a long time. So that was interesting, but also we didn't have an overriding favourite and a team to control. But they sort of made it a little bit more open tour in some ways. While an open tour is more exciting to watch, to race and win or perform well in, it's a little bit harder because it's more unpredictable. So as a rider, you want a more predictable race, so you know what you have to do.
Remind me, what were the big climbs towards the end? Did it go up Galibier, was that?
Yeah, so we had the main stages near the end where I think we did the, is it the Izoard down to Briançon?
Yeah.
And then Lotterey Galibier was when Andy went away on the Izoard.
Yes.
With, I think it was it Fulkstein in the break with him? Can't remember.
Yes, sounds familiar.
But they took a lot of time, but what they did as well was they fatigued so many riders that there wasn't, only the favourites were left to chase. And as we know, the favourites don't often like to chase because, well, if they chase, they're sort of giving the race to one of their main competitors. So and that's where it was up to me, almost on my own, on the Galibier to at least bring back Andy back into, like, we'll put ourselves back into contention.
And you just had to grind it out.
Yeah, and then and that was again just staying calm under pressure. Thanks to my previous losses, I had experience of being in that situation before and having the legs as well, you know. I remember a vivid moment on the race. John and Lang, the director, radios were working there. It was up in the mountains. Okay, Contador struggling. But of course, anyone who's a rider, and especially at that time, when you've got Contador hanging on the back of your group and you've been pulling for 3K and he's struggling, it's like, oh, he must be riding pretty well. Okay, you've dropped Contador. And ride Contador off the wheel in the mountains at the Tour de France. It's like, oh, this is, I am on a good day. You know, these kinds of things are going along and in consideration. Time to the break, how much time were we taking back, or time to Andy. But also, Frank was in the group with me.
Yeah.
So I couldn't, like, I had to save something to go against in case he started attacking me in the final. And this is me, was it three weekends ago, I was in Luxembourg at their ride. We're still great friends.
All friends, yeah, yeah.
Well, actually, we were competitors then, we're friends now.
Well, the other thing that played in your favour was there was the time trial.
Yeah, so that was still to come, but we had the short, it was one of the first years we had like these shorter, or the first time in a long time the tour had these short, sharper stages. So we had I think it was 150 Ks with Telegraph, Galibier, Alpe d'Huez.
Yes.
I wasn't well positioned at the start of the Telegraph. I was a bit far back in the group and Contador is attacked. Anyway, I've gone to move up and felt something gone wrong in my bike, and I think what might have happened, we had these lightweight quick releases. It felt like the rear wheel moved within the frame. And just I was just like, rather than ride this stage with a doubt in my mind, I'll just stop and I'll change bikes. But of course, all of the favourites are up the road in a breakaway then.
Yeah.
And we've got a chase from behind. And then the team were amazing. They just went one off and they knew their order. So they straight away went in their order. Worst climber to best climber, Steve Morabito led me, got me almost to the back of Sanchez.
Yeah.
As long as I could get to the back of Sanchez for the descent of the Galibier, I thought we could come back. Because if we descended over down there together, we could come back to Schlex and the guys there. You may notice it's 12:25.
Uh-huh, lunchtime.
Swiss people have lunch at 12:30, and that's what is possibly why there's a few cars. Anyway.
Like clockwork.
Yes. And I felt that both Andy and Frank were a bit, they wanted to take more time on me and they didn't, and that sort of unsettled them a bit. So going into the time trial, but still we weren't favourites, but I was exactly where I wanted to be, close, and okay, now we just got to do a good time trial. And I'd done Dauphiné that year and done that course in the time trial, so I'd set up my equipment and all my tyres, wheels, everything I'd chosen, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I'd been focused on doing a really good time trial there.
So going into the time trial, you must have thought, I'm going to do this.
Had in my mind, it was possibly going to be really important left at this roundabout.
Yeah.
But this time trial was possibly going to be really important.
The feeling of time trialing into yellow, though, knowing that you just had the parade in Paris to go, must have been incredible. It must have been like winning the Worlds 2 years earlier, you know, proving the naysayers wrong.
I think, from my opinion, you've done a great interview here, because there are two moments in my life where I've had this most amazing, incredible experience, and you've nailed them exactly there, where you're going in those last 3Ks ago, you've taken however much time on Schleck, take right, you've won the tour, you're getting this information over the radio from John Nolan, and it's like, I'm doing 50K an hour, and you know what, I feel like I could do 60. You don't feel your legs, and that's where you have this like euphoria of all these years and coming second. It's just like, oh, how fast do I need to go? What gear do I need to ride? Let's just go. That was an amazing moment coming into the bus. I could just let myself go. Like, I gave out a huge scream, I think, which isn't something I've probably ever done in my life. And just hugging the guys, because they're all sitting there, and they said, I've never been nervous, and there was quite a few established time trialers in the group, Brent and Quincy, and they're all the same. I was more nervous for this tour time trial than I have ever been for any of my own. We'll just slow down here. I think we can take a left here.
Okay.
Just a bit shorter.
How's the border?
Yep, so I can make a Brexit joke here. Do you have your passport?
I'm afraid I don't.
I knew you wouldn't. So we're just going into the EU now.
Anyway, so that weight off your shoulders, like I said when we started talking, of having felt like a nilly man, to then steal the world and tour double, the two greatest jerseys in the sport. You must have thought, this is it now.
Actually, in my mind, I thought, well, I won it once, now I'll go again. And then things started, well, my life changed and the tour, and I have to say, like, the world's is huge in cycling. I will take a right and a left here. The world's is huge in cycling, but the tour is big in cycling. It's huge in sport, but it's so big in sport that it's also out of sport. So still today, I go to Rise and things in Asia, and I'm introduced as the 2011 winner of the Tour de France, or as a Tour de France winner, and whether it's a cycling thing or a non-cycling thing, yeah, it resonates with a lot of people. I'm amazed how many people it resonates with.
More than the world's.
Yeah, much more than the world's. Yeah, the world's, especially to a non-cycling thing, or even within cycling, and it's sort of like when the Tour de France, Andy was world champion, and mountain bike this or whatever. And so, yeah, to put it in perspective in that regard. For me, no, in my mind, I'm like, okay, now we did it, came together once, well, let's do it again. And then afterwards, next year, things just, well, I was doing all the same things, all the same training, but my body wasn't reacting in the same way. And a long story short, I raced the tour with the idea to win it, and I went there. But from February onwards, I was continually getting sick, and I just felt exhausted.
Yeah.
And in August, I was at Tour of Colorado, and same Dr. Max Testa rang me up and said, I've been speaking with a contagious disease specialist, colleague of mine. Don't start the stage tomorrow. I've spoken to the team. They booked you a flight home. Go and sit on your couch for 2 months. This is in August.
Wow.
I'm like, shit, if only I'd known this in February, because I could have rested, come back, and maybe had a chance at doing a good tour.
Yeah.
But
what was it?
I had like a form of chronic fatigue syndrome. I had a virus, but I'd been racing with it for so long. But in endurance sport, the difficulty is the poorest excuse you can make as an endurance athlete is I'm tired. What was the symptom I had? I was tired. Now I can't even use that as an excuse. But my recovery was so compromised. I remember waking up in February at home, and I wake up in the morning and I'd look at myself in the mirror and I'm like, what's happened? I've aged like 10 years.
Uh-huh.
My face was all puffy and had massive water retention, and every effect of overtraining that you can have, I had.
Yeah.
But I was just doing the same training or less than what I was doing at the same time the previous year. And so kept training. Oh, you're tired. Okay, take a rest day. Oh, but at some point, your coaches, and you're going to have to train. You have to get a result. You go to Tirreno Adriatico or something. You've won it the year before and you can't even stay with the first 40 over the climbs. All of a sudden, people start treating you very differently. We'll go this way just because a little bit less traffic. Straight up here. And, I went to the tour, and in hindsight, I was seventh at the Tour de France with chronic fatigue syndrome. That was quite a good performance. As the defending Tour de France champion, not being even competitive, it was a pretty poor performance in the world of cycling.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's where things, the pressure on me, the expectations on me, and not being able to deliver on a sporting mode was so heavy. So we're going to take a left here,
uh-huh.
Up this road left. It's a little bit Italian. So, and all these expectations and pressures were building on me, and it was really hard to deal with.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And in the end, in cycling, so like you said, I've won a world championships and a Tour de France, so basically going to the Tour, anything worse than winning, going to the Worlds, anything less than winning is almost a failure.
Yeah.
If I go to Tirreno Adriatico, less than winning is a failure. Go to Romani, less than winning is a failure. Go to Dauphiné, less than second is a failure. to perform at that level, just to be at that level, is so high, and the requirements physically, mentally, the sacrifices that you have to make. I always looked at my career or my chance to be a professional cyclist as an opportunity. And that opportunity is going to end, So not every day of 20 years, but most days I woke up, what can I do to make the most of this opportunity today? Whether that's training or recovery or racing smartly or trying to get yourself on a good team or... And so when I did my last race, the Great Ocean Road Race, in 1st of February 2015, just across the finish line there, I said, you know what, I don't have any regrets. Reason being, one of the first professionals I ever met when I was about 16 or 17 years old, I remember I met him and he had real bitterness towards the sport of cycling. And here I was aspiring, dreaming of being a professional, and here I meet an ex-professional and he was bitter towards it all. And I was like, shit, I never want to be like that. And I was like, I never want that, but you know, that planted a seed in my head as a young, before I was even a professional. I don't want to have that, so I worked hard, and you know, maybe things hadn't come together in 2011 and being so close and having gone against a couple of people whose results caused suspicion.
Yeah.
I may well have had some of that bitterness. But thanks to those, especially those two results, I retired satisfied and happy. And now, after all the sacrifices and things that I did make, I'm trying to catch up with, which is why, like on the weekend, rather than staying home and training, and as I would have had to if I was a professional, I left my bike at home, took the family, we got in a plane, we went to Sardinia for the weekend and enjoyed it. And here I was, let's go this way to avoid the traffic. But no, just finishing off on that. So, no, I don't miss the racing now. I follow it a little bit, but I certainly don't miss it. But I'm sort of catching up with the sacrifices, the places I went that I wanted to go, I didn't have time to visit, or the people I didn't have time to spend with. Those that are still around, I try and spend that sort of time with them.
Yeah.
And then I'm now just enjoying the bike, and I do work for BMC. I have my own race, the Great Ocean Road Race, which of course is a lot of time, but I'm not in an office 8:30 or 6:30 every day, that's for sure.
And here we are, having crossed from Switzerland into Italy.
And here we are, yeah, I'm going to count it as a day. Look, I'm out working, leave me alone. taking Matt for a ride. Lap of the world's course. Sassone, Val di Mugio. Now we're going to go have a coffee at Luca Paolini's cafe in the Piazza Alessandro Volta in Como, overlooking the lake.
Doesn't get better, mate. Thank you so much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.